So, I mean, you have all these great people telling you about a variety of things. In particular, among the first things you're being taught, you have a set of classes from a couple people on quantum field theory, and then you have another one from Kadanoff on StatMech. And maybe what I was hoping to tell you is that from a theorist perspective, those are essentially the same thing. Now, obviously, they're focusing on different problems. They have different motivations. Lots of things are different, but fundamentally, StatMech, as it's practiced in reality, is essentially the same thing as field theory. And you notice one thing already, I didn't put the word quantum in. Most books you get when you're a particle physicist say quantum field theory, and that's a good thing, but almost everything quantum field theorists do can be rephrased as classical field theory. Sometimes that's a useful thing to do, sometimes quantum is a better way to think about it. So I like just to say field theory. So the point is, why are these things the same? So again, I'm going to babble a little bit, but interrupt me with questions. And at some point, we're going to try and have a more open-ended discussion here. So, you know, if I say something that sounds bizarre, or that sounds bizarre, it probably is. So feel free to call me on it. So the thing that unifies this is that unifies these two things. This up here. Unifies the two things is that they're both ways of describing many-body physics. Okay. Now for StatMech, that's pretty obvious, because for StatMech, what's going on is, you know, you have a bunch of, well, it could be a bunch of atoms, probably when you took a classical StatMech course, because most classical StatMech courses don't teach you much that wasn't known 100 years ago. It's fantastic stuff, but it's very old. And, you know, the problems they were thinking about 100 years ago were, you know, how do gases behave and all that. Nowadays, well, people still think about these problems, but maybe more condensed matter physicists are interested in properties of, well, solids, and in particular, more recently, a lot of people have been thinking about liquids. Again, you're all presumably too young to remember, when I was a student, there was a changeover. Condensed matter physics used to be called solid state physics because they were thinking about materials that, say, were a bunch of spins on a lattice, and the atoms weren't moving. What would be moving is the spin degrees of freedom. So they're not really moving. It just depends on how it's spinning around, say. But more recently, in the last couple decades, for different reasons, people have been thinking about liquids a lot. So there's what are called soft condensed matter physicists, and they're often interested in problems related to biology. I don't know, is that part of their curriculum? Okay, so nobody's going to tell you about soft condensed matter. I'm not a soft condensed matter physicist, but... So soft condensed matter physicists are actually usually do classical physics, and often interesting classical systems are related to biology. So they study, maybe the best way to summarize it is to say they study biological systems, but from a physicist perspective. So they study liquids and things like that. And a thing that a lot of people are studying these days, and let me defer what this actually means to later on. So this is a question you can ask me if you want. They talk about spin liquids. So there was a name change from solid state physics, which is what it was called in the 60s and the 70s, and then started in the 80s. The name changed from from solid state physics to condensed matter, because we're interested in these types of systems. Okay, and how I got on this, as I said, these were many-body systems. These are manifestly many-body. Few-body systems in quantum mechanics, that was done in the 20s and 30s, and that's all done. That's not quite true either. But anyway. All right, so that's sort of obvious why this is many-body physics. Why this is many-body physics is not always obvious. There's an obvious reason. So let me say, so why is particle very many body? So When you're doing stat mech, it's maybe a little bit obvious why you might get a field. So a field is just something that where you're describing, instead of worrying about fixed lattice sites, you write down something like 5x. So an example of a field, saying phi, let's just say E of x. So an example of a field are the ones E of x and B of x. So the usual electromagnetic fields. So that you learned about when you took E and M. So now, you know, you hear all this great stuff, and some of you, I'm sure, have taken classes in quantum fields. And so when you look at one of these textbooks, what they teach you is that, well, to describe the elementary particles, and of course, what is elementary depends on what generation you are, but for any generation, there's a notion of what elementary is. And you need to describe them by fields. And so again, probably everybody's seen a little bit of this. Some of you probably have seen a lot of this. And it's really not that different from this. Again, that's another thing you can ask me about to explain the statement I made before, and I'm just making again, why worrying about classical fields and quantum fields really isn't that different of a problem. So I'll state it and ask me more about it if you want. So the point is, all right, so this is quantum fields, and you know, if you've learned a little bit about it, you know it's very hard. All right, so I'm going to push the magic button. Actually, this would have ruined the fine. So actually, as a tangent, but one I've found fascinating. So I hope you've all looked at the Feynman lectures at some point in your life because they're masterpieces. But when Feynman prepared the lectures, I didn't know this till recently, he actually didn't write out a set of notes. He prepared what he was going to write on the blackboard. And they had the old sliding ones that don't involve technology. It was probably six of them. And he just had a set of index cards, either six or nine, I forget. He had six or nine index cards, and he just wrote out on each index card precisely what he was going to put on the board. The rest was just all in his head. And when he got to the last blackboard, the lecture was done. There was no erasing was involved. So I've always dreamed of striving for that. As you can tell, I'm not quite there. So quantum field, it's a long, hard thing, and there's lots of cool stuff there. And another thing you can ask me about. How is renormalization plays a central role in these things. But so now why fields appear in stat mech maybe isn't so hard to understand, because what happens is if you forget you're on a lattice, or if you forget there's individual particles when you're doing a gas or something like that, you study things by treating them as averaged quantities. And so that's why then you'll describe the degrees of freedom. So again, in stat mech, fields because it's just useful to think of average quantities. So say a density. So instead of talking about the individual locations of the particles, you talk about a density. And that's some number as a function of x. That's some number as a function of x. So that's not so hard to understand why that comes up. But then the question is, why when we do quantum field theory and we're trying to understand what happens inside the nucleus and so forth, why does that require fields? And the reason is actually pretty easy to understand. So say you want to do we want to study relativistic matter. Okay, well, which is basically what particle physicists do. They build these gigantic accelerators precisely to accelerate whatever they're interested in to the speed of light, and they smash it together, and look what happens. So that's given. That's what we want to do. Okay, so that what that means is V is, something like C. Yes, I know it can't be greater than C, but for all practical purposes of this lecture, V is C. So everything's going the speed of light, or at least very close to it. And so when that happens, and it doesn't matter if it's 0.7 C or whatever, but when that happens, well, of course, there's the not very complicated relation, V squared, C squared. You guys are following me, I hope. And then I can do that. And because I put a squiggle in there and not an equal sign, I can put a 1/2. Aren't I allowed to do that? And so what happens, you're seeing, is that the kinetic energy here that's involved is on order the rest energy of the particles. Maybe it's even a lot bigger, who knows? And yeah, this is the non-relativistic formula corrected. But the point is the two are in the same ballpark within factors of 2 or 10 or anything like that. And so it says once that this is relativistic, well, then we're dealing with energies that are order mc squared. Well, once you have energies that are order mc squared, you can create particles. And once you can create particles, well, if you can create two particles, you can create four. And once you're building these things, you can create lots of them. So, in fact, even though particle physics seems like sort of single or few body, I should say, few body physics, it's really multi-particle. Because you can always create this stuff. And then maybe a more evocative way of saying that is that the vacuum, so particle physicists often refer to the ground state as the vacuum. In fact, when I started hanging out with condensed matter people, I kind of started out as a particle physicist and, well, evolved or did something. And, I still use the word vacuum to mean the ground state of some quantum system. And they sneered at me, and they were right to do so, because of all things particle physicists should know well, is that the vacuum is hardly nothing. Because what happens when you study these theories in more detail, the vacuum becomes this sea of particles. Now, in condensed matter physics, this is obvious, because, say, you're dealing with an electron gas, you have what's called the Fermi sea, or the spin example I drew, where you have a bunch of spins. So everybody knows that the ground state there is still some complicated thing, or at least could be some complicated thing. In particle physics, you would by reflex, well, the ground state is nothing. I don't have any particles. But even when you don't have any particles, because you're dealing with energies that are large enough to create particles, you have to worry about that effect. So the vacuum really isn't a vacuum. There's even physically measurable consequences. I don't know. Have people heard of the Casimir effect? Yeah, okay. So that's the energy of all the stuff that's in the ground state. I mean, it's just there. And well, that's the way the world is. So the moral of this story that I just told here is that even though they look like particle theory and condensed matter theory seem like two different fields, they're really not. Now, so notice I said theory. If I had said particle physics and condensed matter physics, those are different fields because the experiments, and even though we're perimeters, so we can laugh, experimental physics actually is a part of physics. In fact, most experimentalists will tell you and me and us that we're the sort of irrelevant hangers on, they're the key. So it is good to bear in mind their attitude that somehow they're more important. We know that's not true, but on the other hand, condensed matter physics is very different from particle physics. There's different questions, there's obviously different experiments, different motivations. Condensed matter, well, you know, I can babble more about that if you want to hear that. But from a theorist point of view, they're very, very deeply related sets of problems. And so there's an enormous amount of back and forth, far more than most people want to admit, between ideas that occurred in the various fields. So to give an example, if you've taken some field theory or even maybe an advanced quantum mechanics course, you learn about spontaneous symmetry breaking. And did anyone, so even though if you learn this in a particle physics context, which is the way most people hear about it first, it occurs in both places. Well, first of all, it was known about for decades in condensed matter physics, although I guess they didn't really remark on it because it seemed so obvious. But in the book, even though it was a particle physics one, what's the example that you were given for spontaneous symmetry breaking? It's always the same. What is it? Yeah, you see, or just a ferromagnet, right? Isn't that? Does anyone have any other different way of being taught spontaneous symmetry breaking? Right. So even so because of particle, and one thing I should, as long as I'm coming at this, one thing particle physicists should do but don't when they explain renormalization. Okay, so who's heard of renormalization here? Wow. Right. About a quarter of you? That's impressive. All right, so when particle physicists do renormalization, I'll say one sentence about this and you can ask me more. When they talk about renormalization, they bill it as this bizarre procedure to remove infinities or sweep them under the rug, depending on how cranky a mood they're in. But if they explained it the way condensed matter people think about it, not only would they just recognize this is how you define your theory, but it would actually be a lot clearer. It's usually unbelievably atrociously explained in particle physics books. So there's actually, so I say it's the same field, and both fields, to be sure, have enormously benefited from the correspondence between the two. So I can obviously babble more, but why don't I start asking some random questions and then I can go off on more tangents? Yeah.
How exactly does renormalization work in condensed matter?
Yeah, so it's, sure, it's yeah, and I should say, you're Leo Kadanoff, who you'll be hearing from, I guess, starting in just a few weeks, right? Or maybe a month,
yep.
Right? Yeah. Was really the key guy in nailing down what was going on. You've probably heard of Wilson, who then, I should say, so Wilson made everything much broader and more elaborate, but the physical picture I'm about to give you is very much came out of, well, there are a bunch of people, but Kadanoff was probably the key person. All right, so let's just take some lattice model, and I'll pick a lattice model, yeah, so that's easiest to draw. Okay, this is the easiest lattice model. You've all heard of the Ising model? Please don't be shy. You haven't. Oh, you have. Okay, good. It's okay. Don't be shy. I don't think I knew about the Ising model until I was in graduate school. So it's a bunch of spins on a lattice. Well, I'm doing this one because it's the easiest to draw it. And instead of being a real spin that can, say, have multiple components, you idealize this by saying it can either only be spin up or spin down. That's the simplification in the Ising model. And right now, I'm going to do classical physics. So this is just a classical quote spin, but instead of being spinning in any direction, it only spins, say, this way or spins that way. So that's the Ising model. And you do a bunch of stat mech, but so the idea of renormalization, well, part of the ideas of renormalization says, well, of course, we're not interested in what each individual spin is doing. That's the whole point of stat mech. What we want to do is understand the behavior of the average, and so you define these fields. And that works for a lot of things. There's this whole long story called Landau theory that explains a lot about how to understand many body systems effectively. But what happened is this broke down. So Landau theory is what probably particle physics would call effective field theory. So if you know what that is, that's good, but you don't need it to know what I'm about to say. But because this breaks down, when you're near a critical point. So again, you've probably heard, again, poll the audience. Everyone know what a critical point is? Again, don't be shy. Everyone's nodding yes. Someone's got to nod no. You don't know. Yeah, yeah. I want to hear, yeah, people, okay, good. I mean, you're all great, but don't be embarrassed. I didn't know any of this stuff when I was starting grad. Well, maybe a few things, but not most of this I did not know when I started grad. So don't be shy. It's actually, it's always good to pretend you're stupid because then people actually explain stuff to you as opposed to, if you pretend you're smart, nobody then bothers to explain stuff to you and then you don't know anything. All right, so a critical point is where a system is scale invariant. There's one in water where the liquid gas transition line ends, but the key defining thing is that physics is scale invariant. And so what that means is you measure physical quantity. It's scale invariance is really weird. It says that there, if I say my universe was just this Ising model, and I'm at the Ising model critical point, which does exist in both two and three dimensions for the Ising model, classical Ising model. So say I'm at that critical point, and that's my whole universe. All I could do is do experiments on this Ising model. I could never measure a length scale. So obviously, when I'm looking here, I see a length scale. There's, you know, some distance, whatever. They're a micron apart or whatever they are. But when I'm, you know, sitting back and I don't have an electron microscope, I'm just doing experiments on this. And I won't be able to do anything to tell whether my Ising system, I'm trapped in the middle somewhere, is the size of a planet or the size of the lab. As long as I don't get as big as the planet or as small as the distance between things. And so that's what scale invariance is. And so this Landau theory that worked marvelously for lots and lots of things didn't work near critical points. Before I explain exactly what that is, it was a very similar issue in particle theory when they were trying to understand what happened at high energies. They got nonsensical answers when they did one-loop computations, if you know what a one-loop computation is. So anyway, so both particle people and condensed matter people were very stuck on what turned out to be the same problem, although I'm not clear that that was obvious to them at that point. Maybe it was obvious to a few people, but not very many. So Kenneth and others said, well, let's now, okay, we don't care what's going on at the individual atom level. We want to look back. You know, we want to, you know, blur our eyes, maybe is the best way. We'll stand way back, and so you can't even tell that. Yeah, so that we can replace it with some sort of average, like I said here. And so Landau does that too. But what Kandoff wanted to do is see very explicitly, how do we do it? So there's a technique called block spinning where he said, well, let's take, I don't know, say a block of four spins. And then, so to be technical for a second, you could do the partition function over all the individual spins and then replace it with an effective spin. And you can even do this exactly. So in other words, I've got one spin here. Now the spin could take on, I guess, how many values is it? Two, it could be plus two, plus zero, minus two. Yeah, three values. But it's a little bit screwy because there's more zero. You already have to be careful because there's more zero states than there are plus two states. So it already gets a little bit tricky. Okay, and then write down effective interactions between the two. Now, you can do this exactly, but that's almost completely useless to do exactly. It just gets horrendously complicated because what we want to do is now take these things and now take bigger blocks and all that and average them out. But we want to do this explicitly. Now, you can't do it exactly, but now you have to try and develop a notion of how to throw stuff out. So what are the important things to keep, and what are the unimportant things to keep? And so there's a concept. So the words, everybody knows what these words mean in the real world. Can everybody see that? It says relevant versus irrelevant. So we all know what those mean in real life, what relevant means and irrelevant, but what the ideas of Kadanoff and then others, and then especially Wilson after him, made those words precise. So they gave a precise notion of a way of trying to determine whether which couplings you need to keep. And it's to understand this, the idea of the critical point is essential. And then the beautiful idea, the very physical idea that came out of all this. All right, so I was told something breaks here, but anyway, I'm going to try. All right, I'm not going to try. So just do scroll. Oh, good, I get that one. So the beautiful thing that happens, where is it? No, I was looking for an eraser, but that's all right. See, my blackboard technique. It's all right. What I'm writing isn't that detailed anyway. So at a critical point, you can make precise the notion of relevant versus irrelevant. So I'll leave that to Professor Kadanoff to explain how to do that precisely. Okay, so, and the word renormalization comes from this procedure, this very physical idea I described, of just changing, of viewing your system with effective degrees of freedom and effective couplings, and then deciding which ones matter. And so what happens is the couplings so we use scale as because it's such a good word. So people in physics say the coupling scale. I should really say, we say scale, but I should use the word renormalize. Avoid confusion. So the couplings change as I scale the fundamental length of the system. So do what I'm doing there. So that's the way it works there, and all this can be made precise. In particle physics, this is this infinities under the rug business. So what happened there, they're doing Feynman diagrams and they're doing a one-loop calculation. And a one-loop calculation, basically when in most, almost all systems or almost all interesting interacting systems, you do it, and if you did it naively, it diverges. So you just do some integral, and the answer for the integral is infinity. So you get depressed, and that's why people are very confused in the 30s when they were first trying to work this stuff out. But the procedure there says, well, say the simplest way is you got a momentum integral and you cut it off at a high momentum. So in particle physics, so you cut off, say, you cut those off at high momentum. Now they're finite. They would be diverging, but now we just cut it off. Well, you think about for a second, a high momentum cutoff is the same as a short distance cutoff, right? So this is equivalent to short distance. And so this is exactly now the same kind of thing. I shouldn't say it's exactly the same thing, but it's definitely the same kind of thing that we do here when we write down a lattice model. And then if you study the behavior of your theory, well, how does it change if we change this cutoff, if we change where we cut off the integral, well, that's exactly the same problem as what happens here when we're changing the size of the system in here. And so this procedure that tells you how to deal with that is actually the same mathematical procedure that tells you how to deal with this. The advantage of thinking about it like a condensed matter physicist is this is all very physical and all, I think, very intuitive, whereas the way it's usually presented in the particle physics world, it's some very abstract mathematical thing. And even though I guess I'm sort of an abstract mathematical person, anytime you can understand something intuitively, physically, that's good. So that's why they're basically, well, that's why they seem to be the same thing. What Wilson did was put all these different ingredients together and explain how that worked. And precisely, and so thus, it really was a killing what seemed to be two birds with one stone. It turned out it was only one bird, but the same stone worked. All right, well, maybe that's a good place to stop there. So good, more, I mean, I've said a lot of random stuff, so someone asked me something about some something random. Yeah. Oh. God, I have never once been accused of being soft. I swear, that's the first time I have ever been accused of being too quiet.
Yes. You mentioned at the beginning that in some sense the classical field theory is the same as the quantum field theory. So could you explain this a bit better?
Oh yeah, good. Okay. Yeah. No, that's a great question, and I'm trying to think of the best way to answer it. So let me make the state. Let me make the. Okay. I don't have an eraser anymore. Oh well. Okay. Let's scroll again and get my eraser back. There. Well. Oh, and I got one more. All right. There we go. So the statement of how that's true, first let me make the statement and then I'll say a little bit about why the statement's true. So the right, so often, this isn't always true, but often, if you have a quantum field theory in D spatial dimensions, can be rewritten as a classical field theory in D plus one dimensions. I think, actually, once I say field theory, I think this is always true. If I'm not doing field theory, then of course, it's not necessarily true. So for example, I'm describing here, the picture I drew, because it's easier, was to draw a two-dimensional Ising model in a two-dimensional classical Ising model. But the physics of this, so actually, yeah, let me write down. Let me be precise. So I'll write down an equation in this lecture, the only one. The physics of the 2D classical Ising model so that the partition function everyone know that notation? That's traditionally notation for nearest neighbors. Most physics, beta is the inverse temperature. So that's the partition function. So the physics of the classical 2D Ising model is identical of the 1D quantum Ising chain. And so there, I would write down the quantum Hamiltonian of a bunch of operators. Oh, I lost the J here. So this is now just a sum in 1D. Okay, so let me write probably a J or something right there. And then the partition function of this thing. Okay, so I wrote down two things. So so the way to prove all this is to use what's called the path integral, which again, probably many of you have seen, but maybe some of you haven't, and that's a little bit involved to explain. So let me just try and say in words why these two give the same physics. All right, so this is the Ising model. It says that there's a bunch of spins, so sigma I is equal to plus or minus one. I haven't told you what those objects are yet, I will. So this is plus or minus one. He says, now the partition function says you sum over all the different configurations of the system. So that's what that thing means, sum over all different configurations of the system. And you give some weight. So depending on whether J is greater than 0 or less than 0, either this weighting wants to make them line up, so that's a ferromagnet, or wants to make them anti-align, which is an anti-ferromagnet. So that's the physics there. And again, everybody's probably seen that. What you may not have seen is this quantum system. So now this is a quantum system where we have a chain of two-state quantum systems. Remember, the Hamiltonian is an operator. So sigma x is the usual Pauli matrix, and this just means acting at the ith site, and then this says, well, flip it. So this is a flip term. And now this one is like an aligning term, or anti-align term, because those are sigma z. Sigma z is the usual one minus one. So let's look at this. So this says, we'll flip a spin. And this says, give it some energy if they're aligned and some other energy if they're anti-aligned for nearest neighbors. So that's I plus one. Okay, well, so now imagine if we took this system, did a different kind of scaling from before. So say we shrunk this distance. So say we increased that coupling or decreased that, I should say, made them closer and increased the coupling or decreased the coupling, scale this in some fashion. Now, along a line here, right, we still have the same kind of deal we had in these two cases. So along a line, I have some interaction that makes spins want to align or anti-align. But in this direction, I can now think of as time. And to be precise, there's an I involved. So people will call this imaginary time or Euclidean time. But that's a technical thing. Don't have to really worry about that. So now you think if I was evolving this in time, so time is going up this way, well, of course, this can be flipped or it can be not flipped. And I can put a weight depending on whether I flip it or not. And so what happens is if you take this, or I should say if you take this, and then put in a jx, so jy and a jx, and then scale jx and jy appropriately, you can get exactly this thing. And what's even cooler is that the inverse temperature is basically the distance around once appropriately rescaled. And so this can, so I didn't make it precise, but you can make this extremely precise. So in other words, take this object and by rescaling horizontal and vertical couplings, turn it exactly into that. So it's no mystery then why the physics is the same. It's because it's the same model in a particular limit. So the same. And yeah, so the path integral is a much fancier field theory way of doing this. Yeah. That's absolutely right. Absolutely. Yeah. So the one thing that's important to note though is actually what I just said though. When you do this, well, first of all, it's actually imaginary time. It's not. You have to analytically continue time, which is called a Wick rotation if you took field theory. But then this distance, you know, you have this notion of distance there, and it's the inverse temperature. But yeah, you're absolutely right. No, it's stunningly beautiful. But you know, of course, it took people decades of doing these sorts of things before all this was recognized. Nowadays, in condensed matter physics, the people who aren't soft condensed matter people traditionally do quantum problems. So their intuition these days is mostly guided by studying things like this, and the reason is, of course, because that's what they study in the lab. That's the more relevant problem for them, and so people like to think of that. This is often much simpler to think about, and again, it depends on what you're computing. Sometimes this is easier, and yeah, when you do the path integral and you do all that, it's the same computation. One other comment. So this thing here. As long as I'm ranting about field theory books, the one thing that drives me absolutely bonkers, how are we on time? I'm good? Okay, good, I'll take it. Is in particle physics books, they traditionally start out with Lorentz invariants. And so one of the reasons why I distinguish that, there's absolutely no reason why any condensed matter system you study is Lorentz invariant. In fact, there's no reason why all particle physics systems are. If you do something at finite temperature, for example, you break Lorentz invariants. So, but particle physics books that start with an explanation of Lorentz invariants, I think, are somewhat deceiving that that's fundamental. It's not fundamental to anything. It's useful. It's extremely useful. If you have Lorentz invariants, go with it and use it. But it's not fundamental field theory whatsoever. But the statement I made doesn't require Lorentz invariants, and that's why I single. So, you know, so often when people say D plus one dimensions, they mean a Lorentz invariant theory. But I really mean a theory in D spatial dimensions, and then there's one time dimension. And so thus, this classical field theory may be anisotropic. So there is no rotation between time and space like it is when you have Lorentz invariant. Yeah?
So Lorentz
invariant
is kind of related to being able to use special theoretical.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. But so that's true, except in condensed matter physics, actually, it occurs a lot. And the reason is because in condensed matter physics, in many problems, we have a Fermi C. So everybody knows what Fermi C is, right? So, you know, you've got, let's just do non-relativistic fermions. So, right? So the energy is then just the sum of the individual energies. But of course, because they're Fermi, that's p squared over 2m, but of course, since they're fermions, you can only put one there. You know, then you put ones there. Same before in three dimensions. But usually, we're interested in low energy physics. Everybody ultimately is interested in low energy physics. Even the high energy physicists, they want to see they study what happens at high energy, so they can understand what happens at low energy. And so we're understanding just what's going on here. These guys are just parked there. And so if you linearize. Around the Fermi velocity, you basically, let's go back over here. So if you write now E is equal to some constant, plus if you want to study what happens just around there, you just get these things there. And so notice that's all some constant that these ones way at the bottom. But now notice you get E of the excitations obey. So the Fermi velocity plays the role of the speed of light, and you're in a relativistic system. So relativistic invariance, yeah, so I don't mean to poo-poo Lorentz invariance. It's of a central importance in condensed matter physics as well as particle physics. It's just not the only game in town. And there's lots of interesting systems that don't do it, including many of the ones I study. So that's maybe why I'm biased. Good. Any more? You're stuck with me for a few more minutes. So. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I sort of follow the Fibonacci model, the Fibonacci model, but what if you were to say, you know, from the question I had, that would be similar?
Yeah, I mean, so that would be what a particle physicist would do with the path integral, which is really the easy. Yeah, so in fact, before the path integral, that was an excruciatingly hard problem because with the electromagnetic field, you have to deal with the fact that there are no transverse modes, which is a very bizarre thing. You have to deal with gauge invariance. And so these problems were solved in quantum field theory from a canonical thing where you're not doing a path that you're not thinking about this D plus one dimensional thing. You're just thinking about doing a quantum field in D dimensions. And you can then do all these complicated, there's the Gupta-Bleuler quantization. Again, if any of you have taken a field theory class, you've heard this. It's horrendously complicated. It actually becomes much easier to sort of go up one dimension and then think about the classical theory in four dimensions. So that's why these days, in fact, when, you know, actually, you know, so I still talk to people from both things. And now the proof that I'm a condensed matter physicist, not a particle physics, you know, I say the world is three-dimensional. And my friends across the aisle, you know, say the world is four-dimensional. And because that's for them, that's actually the way for almost everything is a much, much easier way, especially because you have Lorentz invariance usually. And so thus, exploit it and then just do everything there and it becomes much easier. Yeah, so it's a whole horrible story to quantize the NM field.
You're saying you just start with what you just take the classical action and put it into it.
Yeah, yeah, right. No, that's, well, it's still some work because of these subtleties. Right, I mean, that was what they did in the 30s, you know, and then they got these divergences and all this, and you have to check that you never make a transverse field even when you compute quantum corrections, and it's right, it seems easy, but in principle, that's exactly, you take the Maxwell action, and if you put in electrons too, you do there. But, yeah, right. And at some extent these days, it is easy. That's a standard quantum field theory text. We'll teach you QED, which is how to do it.
Let me get this right. So you're saying to quantize, say, electromagnetism, it's easier to go one dimension?
Well, to treat time as a dimension and then exploit.
And then use a classical approach to that?
Well, it's still field. So field theorists, particle theorists have gotten so good at this, they actually don't even really sort of say it anymore. I mean, they're still doing field theory. But what I should say, what they would prefer to do instead of using a Hamiltonian, so if you could summarize one difference between condensed matter people and particle people, condensed matter people use Hamiltonians and particle people use Lagrangians.
Right.
And so that was the sort of great insight, is that technically it just gets much easier to deal with the Lagrangian, but then you do an action, so you put, you know, the LDT, and so you effectively have everything in space-time. And you know, you write all this wonderful covariant notation, but yeah, it still work. But now that work has really been understood. Quantizing can be more difficult because you have to pay attention to what your Hilbert space is. You know, physicists tend to blow off all this stuff that mathematicians worry about. But like I say, in E&M, because of gauge invariance and because you know, gauge degrees of, you know, if you just do a gauge transformation, of course, that's not a real physical degree of freedom. And that's a lot of work. For QED, it's been done. So for QCD, people do Hamiltonians in QCD, but almost never. I mean, it's all done there. And because that's just where the tools exist. And also, you learn a lot more. So there's another story about topological excitations or instantons and things like that. And that's much, much, again, easier to think about when you're dealing with the full D plus one dimensional theory in that context. On the other hand, I said before, sometimes you just don't have Lorentz invariants, so you got what you got. So, yeah.
But then it will be you wrote a classical field theory D plus one, but it will be the quantum field theory D plus one.
Yeah. They call it a quantum field theory, but it's really a classical field theory. Right. There's no. Because you're not, so when you think, what I mean by quantum, right, operators acting on Hilbert space, right? These are not operator, I mean, again, because people go back and forth all the time. So when I say classical field theory, I'm not talking about operators. You do a path integral, you sum over all the field configurations, space-time. Just like in the Ising model, when I wrote down the partition function, I just sum over all the spins in what later I called space and time. And so really, it's just a classical field theory. I mean, they're doing a quantum system, but the quantum system is with the Hilbert space and the operators is really in three dimensions.
So path integral is not something that I usually think about as a classical thing, but I guess.
Yeah, well, it's got an I in it. I mean, I've cheated on the I. That's the, I'm okay. Pretending that the I doesn't matter, and actually, most of the time, it doesn't. It does sometimes.
So if we don't have any operators on the classical field theory side, what is the way that we can tell the classical theory whether the quantum theory describes bosons or fermions?
Yeah, well, so then typically what you have to do is go back and think about, that's an excellent question. Yeah, what you do to see that is actually write down the Hamiltonian. So, I mean, if you look at a good field theory book, you know, like Peskin is one. When I teach field theory, that's what I use. You go back and you look at Hamiltonian, and then so you do write it out that way. So absolutely, I mean, sometimes that's just the question. Because when you say the statistics of particles, you really mean their behavior when you move them around in space. It's sort of on a fixed time slice. People are sloppy about this, but yeah, you really mean space. Yeah, so that's really.
If you just write down the Hamiltonian as a function of the fields, and you do not assume the spin statistics theorem, then it is not obvious from the Hamiltonian whether the fields are fermionic or bosons.
No, it's not. It's not at all. No, it's not. I mean, the spin statistics theorem is a very powerful thing because it answers that question. But if you didn't know about the spin statistics theorem, and I spent a lot of time for various reasons studying anions, which are these 2+1, so 2 spatial dimension particles. That aren't bosons are fermions. They give you a phase, for example, when you take them around each other. And there's things that they behave in some ways like their spin statistics. So they have fractional spin and fractional charge and fractional statistics. But there's no theorem that requires that. So you very much have to deal with it. But having said that, again, you formulate them in the Hamiltonian language. You can reformulate that in terms of a field theory computation. It's related to a Berry phase computation. So it is. It's certainly a quantum question because statistics have no meaning outside of a quantum system. But it's a question that you can then reformulate in the classical language, if you didn't know the answer already. But in 3+1 dimensions, you kind of know the answer already. 2+1 dimension, where I tend to live these days, you don't know the answer.
Okay. I wonder if the conference organizers might not be.
Yeah. All right. Am I out of time? Yeah.
Wondering where you are.
So, oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
That's right.
All right.
Okay,
yeah. Well,
so
yeah. Sure.
Let's
okay. Good.
All